Tarahumara Apache Indian picked a few of them off. This was going to be some dirty business. I looked back up the canyon wall and counted the headlights. There were at least a dozen motorcycles. Well, hell, maybe some of them will fall off before they get here. The mules took notice of our hiding place and ambled over to investigate. I hissed at them, and they looked at me like I was crazy, and then came closer to make sure we were all right. Isidro ignored them, and I was pretty sure he was of the mind that, when the shooting started, our noble steeds would make a hasty retreat. I decided to move them off. They'd done us good service and called it the rancher's son and me, but I couldn't stand the thought of them being shot. The trail bike motors sounded like a swarm of angry hornets as I stepped out from the boulders and moved toward the mules. Come on, guys, get out of here. Yeah, yeah! They stood there looking at me. Remembering that they probably only spoke Spanish, I used one of my few words, and this time I yelled, Vamos! Vete! They studied me some more. Not wanting to fire any of the weapons in hopes of not wasting any more ammunition, I picked up a pebble and pitched it at the lead mule, who flinched and then redirected his large ears toward me. I picked up another pebble, and they all took a step toward me, curious. I dropped the pebble, shook my head and rejoined Isidro, who was smiling as he leaned against the back of the boulder. The bikers had taken the trail away from us in order to get some level land before turning back to make the run at the bottom of the canyon toward us. I was thinking there were at least a dozen of them, which didn't bode well. Even if Isidro tagged eight, that meant four of them could set up camp and take potshots at the remainder of our party. There just weren't enough of us. I looked at the mules. The mules looked at me. I thought about the story I had told Bianca, the one about Ambrose Bierce and the counterattack near Brown's Ferry. If my estimations were right, it would be another couple of minutes before the dirt bikes made flat ground and would be bunched up in the narrow pass for the charge. Smiling at Isidro, who was studying me with a curious expression, I climbed up on the boulder and the mules moved in even closer. Checking the magazine and then slapping it home, I selected full auto and then pushed the button to close the bolt. Propping the butt of the stock on my hip, I pointed the barrel skyward and addressed the combatants, with all apologies, to Tennyson. Half a mile onward, right toward the Georgia troops, broke the 200. Forward, the mule brigade! Charge for the rebs, they neighed! Straight for the Georgia troops, broke the 200! Squeezing the trigger, I cut loose with a quick burst and watched as the mules spun, bucked, crow-hopped, and then took off at a high rate of speed back down the trail from whence we'd come. They quickly disappeared around the corner, and I listened to the sounds of shrieking men, screeching metal, and braying mules. It was with a great deal of satisfaction that I watched as the four mules appeared in quick succession. They were heading up the trail, apparently unhurt, racing up the narrow path back toward the village. I wasn't too concerned about their health, figuring that they would stay in the high meadows where there was plenty of food and water until somebody found them. Isidro stood, looking at me and shaking his head, finally coming around the boulder and starting toward the area where we'd last heard the motorcyclists. I followed as he began trotting, and after a couple hundred yards we rounded the corner and took in the devastation. There were motorcyclists everywhere, most of whom had crashed among the boulders, almost all of them unconscious and bleeding, with only a few sitting up, although clearly dazed. There was one man standing in the path, holding his arm and turning in circles, trying to figure out what had just happened. I punched him hard in the gut and then sat him down in the path. We picked our way through the broken men, gathered the scattered weapons, and checked them for other weapons as we went. The final rider was trapped under his bike, where it had gone off the road and then caught traction and flipped over and back onto him. He was holding a pistol and had it trained on us as we approached. I was hoping it was Bedard, but we weren't that lucky. His leg was turned in an awkward angle, and I was pretty sure it was broken. The semi-automatic shook in his hand as he aimed it at us. I stopped about 3 paces from him. Hola! You speak English? He spat, and then gestured with the 9mm. I speak with this! I glanced at Isidro, who had the barrel of Epitafio pointed at the man's head. If you're not careful, this conversation is going to be over before it starts. He snorted. I'm the only one of us who speaks the English. Where's Bedard? He gestured with the pistol. He's never far, gringo. I crouched down and studied him. Look, your leg is broken, and probably a couple of other things, too. Now we can leave you here under your motorcycle to die, or we can gather you up with the others and put you over against those rocks. He snorted, studying me with wavering eyes. Why would you do such a thing? Because I'm a police officer. He wheezed a laugh. So was I. I was sworn to protect and to serve. So was I. But I found something that paid better, though not quite as worthwhile. He grinned and re-aimed. It's the things you do, the things you leave behind that matter. And I think killing you will be something worthwhile, yes? I nodded toward Isidro, who was now even closer. You'll never get the round off. Maybe, maybe not. Where's Bedard? Are you the one that set the mules on us? I think the mules made that decision themselves, but I might have helped. I waited a moment and then pushed my hat back on my head. Where's Bedard? He gestured with the gun again, motioning behind us. We have a saying in our country that you are permitted in times of great danger to walk with the devil until you have crossed the bridge. What's that supposed to mean? You'll find out, gringo. He redirected the 9mm toward me, and Isidro fired, knocking his head back as if it had been kicked by one of the long-gone mules. His faceless body slumped to the side and twitched a few times before lying still. We disentangled the rest from their bikes and dragged them to the slight overhang, doing our best to make them comfortable using all their supplies except for one wool blanket-sided canteen which I kept for myself. One young man looked vaguely familiar, with his American soccer ball cap. Ivar? He avoided making eye contact with me. I nudged his leg with my boot. Ivan, the last time I saw you, we made a deal that if we saw you again, we're going to stitch your face to a soccer ball.
Yeah.
What the hell are you doing down here trying to kill me? His head shrank down on his neck like a turtle trying to become invisible.
I had nowhere to go.
How about landscaping in Tucson? I glanced around. How about anywhere but here? I shook my head and pulled out my wallet, snatching a couple of fifties and handing them to him. Once we get out of here, buy some help. He looked at the bills.
Is this all you got?
You know, I may kill you myself. Isidro, standing to the side, raised his weapon, but I waved him off. Look, you're the most mobile of the light brigade. Hang around for a few hours, and then, if nobody comes looking for you, take off and get help from one of the towns, okay?
Nobody's going to come looking for us.
He glanced around. Maybe I can get one of the local ranchers to come help, but it'll take more money. So much for the milk of human kindness. I pulled out a couple more fifties and handed them to him. Do it, and if you leave these guys down here to die and I hear about it. I threw a thumb at Isidro. I'll send him after you, and believe me, you don't want that. He nodded, glancing at the Indian, who looked like some vision from an Edward S. Curtis photograph, with the exception of the M1C Garand sniper rifle. Now, one more thing. Where's Bedard?
I don't know. Honest.
Was he the one that sent you and your friends after us?
Yeah.
When and where was that?
At the monastery.
That seemed curious. So before the avalanche?
Yeah.
Then why did it take you so long to catch up with us?
The avalanche?
And we went down the road because we thought that was the way you went. Did you see my daughter?
No.
He wasn't telling me everything. So I crouched down there, very close to him, and leaned in. Did you see a pink Cadillac? He avoided my eyes.
Yeah.
I reached out and gripped his chin, pointing his face at mine, moving in even closer. Where?
On the road. But there was nobody in it.
Chapter 14. Even in my agitated state, I couldn't keep up with Isidro. Maybe it was my age, lack of sleep, the heat, the beating, dragging around bodies or what, but no matter how hard I tried, I could feel myself slowing down. The two of us kept climbing, and I continued to look ahead to see if we could catch a glimpse of the others, but so far there was nothing except the flat, horizontal light peering over the canyon edge like an empty page. The temperature was rising with the sun, and my energy was playing out as we climbed, but I was a long way from stopping. I wasn't sure how long it took to get to Aiden's place, but I hoped that Katie would be there. Maybe the Cadillac wouldn't start. It had shown a propensity. Maybe they'd gotten a ride in a better vehicle more suited for the mountain roads. My mind raced ahead of me on the trail, leaving me in the mental dust. Looking back, I could see Ivan peeking out from under the outcropping, and I was pretty sure that he was simply waiting till we were out of sight to abandon his compañeros with my couple of $100. Ah, the honor of thieves. I trudged after Isidro, feeling like a grizzly bear trailing a pronghorn antelope. I stopped, resting an arm on an adjacent boulder, and adjusted the M16 strap. I wiped the sweat from my face, and when I looked up, Isidro was staring at me from above. "Sorry, not as young as I used to be." Predictably, he said nothing. Pushing back my hat, I shook my head. "Who am I kidding? I couldn't have kept up with you in my prime." I started toward him. "Played college ball at USC. I was an offensive lineman, got my degree in English." I smiled. "That's why I speak it so good." I caught up with him and pulled out the confiscated canteen which I held out to him. He declined. "Maybe I should have taken Spanish." He grinned. Unscrewing the top, I took a swig. "Thank you again for my life." He nodded once and then turned to head up the trail as I put the purloined canteen away and started off again. After a while, it became obvious that our two paces were not going to match. "Isidro!" From the next switchback, he turned to look down at me. "You go ahead, and I'll catch up at the top. I'm just slowing you down, and I'd rather you be up there with them than hanging around here waiting for me." He tilted his head in an almost canine confusion. I pointed toward the rim of the canyon. "I don't want them up there without protection." He quickly nodded and then doubled his pace, and in a matter of moments his thin legs and tired tread sandals were out of sight. After what seemed like a couple of forevers, the added high-test adrenaline was beginning to peter out, and I was just glad to make it to level ground as I took one last look at the canyon bottom and then walked over the edge into a flat, ochre-colored landscape that stretched as far as my tired eyes could see. It was like a huge, dead beast, leonine in color, with ridges resembling desiccated ribs that rose without grace. The carrion land. Isidro was not there, and neither was anyone else. I slowly turned in all directions, but all I could see was the heat undulating from the baked surface of the desert like invisible samba dancers. I wished for a sound, but pressed hard against the sky. The terrain gave no answers. There were a few cactus and sagebrush sprigs to break the monotony, but the track seemed to go on forever, and pressed here between sky and earth, I could only see the shape and roundness of the earth. I took a few more steps and stumbled over the wash of an old two-track that had grown over. A few of the pieces of sagebrush were bent, and as I looked closer, I could see the imprint of tires in the powdery sand. The tire marks were fresh, off-road truck tires which looked to be pulling on all four wheels. Someone had been here, and recently. I turned around, slowly, trying to spot a trail of dust that might give me an indication of where they'd gone, but there was nothing. I backtracked and moved to my left, where I could see that our group had stood in a bunch and then had either been forced into a vehicle or had driven off in one of their own, but if that was the case, who was driving the truck? How did they get here, and why would they leave Isidro and me behind? I didn't like it. I didn't like it one bit. And where the hell was my sniper? There was a strange noise, almost like a chirping, and I turned in a circle in an attempt to locate it. It was only after a moment that I realized it was the sat phone in my pocket. I pulled the thing from my shirt, glanced at the further damage it had incurred, and then hit the green button and held it to my ear. "Howdy. Now where in the wide world of fuck are you?" "Hi, Vic." I licked my lips and swallowed. "Henry call you guys?" "He did. And Negroda and the rest of them are trying to get a GPS positioning off of that satellite phone in your hands, so don't you dare hang up." There was some jostling, and her voice became more personal. "Other than where, how are you?"
"Tired."
I glanced around.
I thought we'd gotten away, but I'm thinking something's happened, and now I'm not so sure.
Are you hurt?
I breathed a laugh. A little beat up, but fine. Well, this place is a clusterfuck. Did you set off some kind of thermonuclear device in that village?
No, I just ignited some old sulfur mines as a diversion.
Well, it also ignited a panty bunch of international proportions. The Mexican government now thinks there's some kind of military intervention going on their soil and are refusing to assist.
I'm never eating Mexican again.
What?
There was more fumbling.
I don't fucking know. I'll ask him.
More fumbling.
Walt, why isn't your phone giving us a GPS positioning?
How the hell should I know? I held the thing out, staring at the screen as if it did me any good, and then put it back to my ear.
Is there a button for that? They say they're not getting anything.
I glanced around in all directions. Look, I'm about 7 miles east of the village. Whoever the others are, I've got to find them before we can do anything, so work on the assumption that I'm headed due east by northeast at a walking pace.
Walt, I've got to go.
Punching the button before she could reply, I stepped into the sand and started following the tracks. I hadn't gone far when I saw something standing upright on a flat rock in the center of the road. I reached down and picked up the gleaming 180-grain 30-06 round and held it up to the sun, turning it in my fingers until I saw the tiny sign of a cross scratched in the brass casing that Guzman had mentioned a couple of lifetimes ago. Isidro. They'd gotten him, too. Or he'd seen something and hadn't had time to come back for me. Slipping the calling card into my shirt pocket, I looked in the direction where the road disappeared like the vanishing point of a surrealistic painting and started walking toward the horizon, following the tire tracks and looking for the prints of the Indian sandals. The sun was about an hour from reaching its zenith, and I judged the temperature to already be in excess of 100 degrees. The sweat burst under the band of my hat, ran to the end of my nose, and dropped on the sand, making a slight indentation, which quickly evaporated. It was like walking in a convection oven. I tried to think back to the conversation I'd had with Aiden about the layout of the area, and I remembered him saying it was about 5 miles to the canyon from his place. I could only hope that by following the road, I was taking the right direction. I'd gone about 100 yards when I hit a fork. Staring at the dust, I could plainly see that the tire tracks headed slightly south, which was strange because I could have sworn from the set of the sun that the ranch was slightly north. I looked at the tire marks again, still not seeing any sign of Isidro, and then set off after whatever vehicle had made them. A vast and prehistoric basin, covered with mica, basalt, feldspar, and quartz that reflected the sky like a shattered mirror, a land where ice claws had ripped deep arroyos, wounds that then had been healed by the wash of ancient waters, a land that now thrived with mesquite, cactus, and Spanish bayonet, a place with a snake of low blue hills at the horizon. I found the first body an hour later. Trudging around a rock shelf, I could see something lying in the ditch ahead, a few turkey buzzards picking at it. I ran toward the body, scattering the vultures, and flipped it over, finding the electronic whiz Lowry with his throat cut. The desert had greedily drunk up the blood from his almost severed head, the neck cut with a surgeon's precision, the fatal wound looking almost like a wide, lipless second mouth. The California kid's dry eyes stared out straight into the burning sun, and even in death, the cocky smile still played on his sand-covered lips. I sat there holding him for a few moments, and then dragged him to the side of the road, propping him against the rocks. I'm not sure why. Maybe I was showing respect. Maybe I was a lawman used to clearing the road, and then maybe it was just something to do. I went through his pockets, but there was nothing, and it was only when I eventually stood that I came face to face with a second Springfield 30-06 round standing erect on the rocks. Noting the scratched cross, I stuffed it in my pocket and again glanced around, trying in vain to find tire track sandal prints. Then I started off again, without looking back. Unless I dreadfully misjudged Isidro, my assumption had been correct. Bidart's men must have taken the others who had covered for the Indian and me, and when Isidro had gotten to the flat, he'd seen a vehicle and had given pursuit in hopes of keeping them in sight, leaving messages for me in the only tongue in which he spoke. I pulled the canteen up and started to take a swig, but then decided I'd better start rationing if I was going to make it to who knew where. Placing a hand at the small of my back, I stretched in an attempt to drive away the muscle cramps. The makeshift road continued to sweep southeast, and I dragged my feet along the tracks until the surface of the desert changed, becoming harder with less vegetation. The hard pan gave way to the dead south where the trail end of the mountains curled to the southeast, and I couldn't help but think I was headed in that direction toward the Orfanato or Torero, and not north to Aiden's ranch. It seemed as if I'd been walking for hours, my legs and back cramping, and my throat feeling like the road I was walking on. So I opted for a swallow of water. I unscrewed the top and took a deep slug. As near as I could tell, I still had a quarter of my water supply left. I set off again, but the spasms were getting worse. All I could think about was finding a shady spot to rest, of which there was none. I kept moving. Somewhere out there was my daughter. And if they thought I was giving up short of dying, they had another thought coming. The second body was lying in the road just like the one before. Even from a distance, I could see it was Alonzo, lying on his back, his throat cut from ear to ear. Once again, the blood had poured onto the ground, but here the rocky surface refused the young man's blood, and the stuff was everywhere, drawing flies that buzzed around me as I stooped and turned his jaw to look in his face. His eyes behind the broken thick lenses were still, but his face held the rigor of a vicious battle. He must have seen how Lowry had gone and decided it wouldn't be as easy to kill him, but he was dead nonetheless, and for the second time that day, I dragged a body from the road. I was panting with the exertion, and putting my hands on my knees, took a deep breath, and glanced around, still seeing nothing but the endless expanse of desert. The sun was now directly above, and I felt like the flesh was burning from my bones, even with my palm-leaf hat, the light striking the desert and bouncing back up at me like grease in an overly heated frying pan. Taking the next step, I wavered a bit and used the stock of the M16 to steady myself. A little panic ran through me as my eyes wavered, and I felt my balance giving way again. Finally, standing still, I looked at the minimal shadow that I cast, barely covering my dust-covered boots. There must have been water at some point that had maybe filled the flat distance, but the water was gone now, leaving behind a hardened crust of gray mud that broke apart with the weight of my boots like thin-set tile. I took a step and then stood there looking at the cracks spreading out from beneath my feet. It looked like the entire world was covered with dirty ice, ready to break through and swallow me up. Taking the second step, I looked down and saw a .30-06 round lying on an elevated portion of the dried mud. I reached down to pick it up, and as I did, I could feel my balance giving way, and I crashed into a rut in the road. I just lay there for a moment to catch my breath, watching the dust scatter as I shot air from my nostrils. I could feel the sun on the side of my face where my hat had come off. Finally, rolling onto my side, I reached out and took the bullet, placing it in my shirt pocket along with the others. How many were dead? I couldn't even remember. When had this all started, and how many would be dead before it ended? I had to get up or I would be part of the count. But somehow I couldn't and put my head back on the ground. Lift up your head and heart. I'm tired. I don't care. I can't move. You can. You simply have to want to, old man. Lift up your head and your heart will follow. Sliding a boot beneath me, I shifted my weight and leveraged the rifle so that I could lean into it. I looked around for Virgil White Buffalo, but he wasn't there. Taking a few more deep breaths, I gathered my hat and pushed myself up, nearly collapsing from the strain, but my legs held, and I stood there, pulling the rifle sling onto my shoulder with the canteen. My hands and feet were swollen, making me feel like I was carrying a weight that was suspended from my arms and legs like the pendulum bobs hanging from the lyre on a grandfather clock. I stepped forward in time, swinging my other leg past in opposition with my arms, and found I'd taken a step, then another, and another, using the momentum to lurch forward. I thought about how the 7-foot crow shaman showed up in desperate times and wondered if I could summon him up again, for shade if nothing else. Dropping my eyes, half blinded by the white-hot brass eye of the sun, I looked into the distance and thought I could see something up and to the right. When I got closer, I saw that it was an abandoned vehicle, an old truck from the early 1900s, with large metal wheels, solid rubber tires, and steel-plated sides. Pretty sure I needed shade more even than water. I staggered up beside the thing and pulled open the back door, but the wave of heat that greeted me convinced me that trying to sit in the thing was going to be like trying to rest in a stove, never mind the abandoned mud nests that adhered to the roof of the metal structure, the inside coated with swallow dung. Satisfied with sitting on the lip of the doorway, I looked up at the rounded turret in the rear and the heavy rivets where the monster had been stitched together. Thinking back to pictures I'd seen of Pershing's punitive expedition during the Mexican Revolution, I couldn't help but think that this old fella had been driven down here and then abandoned. I knew how it felt. There was a plate inside the door that read, Thomas B. Jeffery Company, Kenosha, Wisconsin. You need to get moving, lawman. I know. I just need a second. She needs you. I spoke to the dwarf juniper and the candelilla that must have leached some more.